Well, I'd like to thank the organizers for this opportunity to talk about a project that's been going on up in Ithaca, New York, in the USDA land, in the Robert Polly Center, for a couple of years now. It's involved a number of different groups, principally mine, at a low level of intensity, and Ray Glahn's lab, my collaborator down the hall, at a high level of intensity, along with contributions from some of our senior colleagues, our center director, Leon Cochin, and then Ross Welch. Some of the work that I'm going to mention would not have been possible without an informal collection of collaborators across the country, so thanks to my friends, and then all of us, myself, Ray, Leon, and Ross, have been supported by ARS Base Funds. Leon and I were able to leverage some money from NSF Plant Genome, and then Ray and Ross were both supported by Harvest Plus for much of this work. As we've already heard from Kevin, approximately 2 billion people around the world are iron deficient, and we know how to fix this. We know that diverse diets, food product supplementation, and medical intervention are all effective strategies, but generally they really only reach urban dwellers or those that are either economically empowered or within the reach of their governments or NGOs. But they're not practical solutions for subsistence farmers who are consuming a majority of calories they produce themselves. They're not going to the market and buying fortified flours. They're not within the reach of public health officers that could provide them with medical supplements. And so while on the longer time scale, having functional food systems is obviously a desirable goal, perhaps in the shorter term, biofortification is a more reasonable solution to reach the rural poor, as it's a more cost-effective and sustainable strategy for this massive public health problem. And to give you a sense of how massive, I mean, this is really one of the things that's holding back the Global South. And I don't understand why this isn't looking so well, but this is an analysis by ag economists at FAO on the loss of gross domestic product every year. So in a country like Bangladesh, they're losing 8% of their GDP every year due to iron deficiency anemia, due to a combination of inability of adults to do heavy physical manual labor and inadequate mental development in their children. So this is not a problem for just Asia. It's also a widespread problem in Africa and also in Latin America. So if we can figure out how to overcome IDA, we could make substantial gains to the quality of life around the world. Two of the questions that I've been interested in for a couple of years now are the genetic and environmental factors that determine grain iron concentration, or what I'll call FEGC, and grain iron bioavailability, or FEGB. And as this is largely a proof of concept study, we're using a well-understood recombinant inbred population in maize, the intermated B73 by Missouri 17, RI population, and then a number of backcross derivatives that I've made as a study system. So your mother probably told you at some point that you are what you eat. And nutritionists can build experimental diets, vegetarian and non-vegetarian, that are very similar in nutrient concentration. However, a nutritionist would say instead that you are what you don't excrete. Now look on the left. This goes to 15. Scale on the right only goes to 4. So the takeaway message from this is that the foods we consume are chock full of compounds that inhibit our body's ability to absorb nutrients and use them. So perhaps looking at bioavailability, given this strong discrepancy between plant-based foods and more omnivorous foods, is a better breeding goal, if you have the tools to do so, than just looking at concentration. And to do that, fortunately for me, Ray Glahn, a number of years ago, developed a bioassay using a human cell culture called CAECO, which is a colon cancer cell line that can be tricked to grow like an epithelium. So we can take foods and prepare them. In this case, we're talking about cooking and grinding, and then subject them to a mock treatment. Well, it's a mock GI treatment, although it is a very real treatment involving digestive enzymes and low pH, and then basically feed this food product to these human cells, harvest them, and then look for biomarkers for nutritional quality. And we applied that to a subset of the IBM population, looking at about 145 RILs. And here's the distribution for iron bioavailable responses, where in the same samples, we saw far less variation for iron concentration than we did for bioavailable iron. So the bioavailable iron is about a sevenfold minimum to maximum. Iron concentration was something less than threefold. Unfortunately, this little table here represented six-person months worth of work in the lab. But it gave us two really encouraging pieces of information. The first, as Kevin sort of alluded to, this was the range of variation that Ray's lab had previously observed surveying breeding lines for Harvest Plus. So we were already seeing much wider variation in this biparental population than the breeding lines, the elites that were being sent. And furthermore, at the high end, we were already looking at the target goal for Harvest Plus. So by dumb luck, in this biparental population, we were getting lines that might be exactly what Harvest Plus wanted to get to. So in looking at what's going on here, looking for correlations, now here's the grain iron concentration in the samples plotted against the bioavailable iron. And you can see there is this sort of generally positive trend, but it doesn't explain very much. So iron concentration in these samples is not a major driver for bioavailable iron. And another thing to look at, which I'm sure Victor Raboy will tell us more about, is phytate in these samples. And it turns out that in this population, there's very little variation in phytate. So the levels that we observed at low, intermediate, and high bioavailable iron were basically the same. So whatever's at work here, it's neither phytate nor iron concentration. But we could identify QTL in the population using composite interval mapping. We could explain three major QTL, explaining something more than a quarter of the variance. And then using a single marker method like GLM Select and SAS, we could explain something more than half of the total phenotypic variance, which again was far more variance explained for bioavailable iron than for iron concentration in the same samples. As I mentioned before, doing the single sweep for QTL analysis of 145 RILs grown in one location took 6-person months worth of work. But now that we've got QTL identified, I developed sister lines out of BC2S3 derivatives from various IBM RILs to provide a more convenient experimental system. And I did it both in the Missouri 17 background and in B73. So in green, here's the difference in bioavailable iron. The difference in the Missouri 17 background is significant, although it isn't that large for this particular sister pair, but much larger in the B73 background. And if we look at iron concentration in the same samples, there's no difference in the B73 sister pair, and it's actually opposite to expectation in the Missouri 17 pair. But now looking at four lines is a whole lot easier than looking at 150 or even 302. And so this provided us some new opportunities. The first of which was to ask, were we just looking at something that was boutique to upstate New York? And so I called a number of people and asked them to add a couple of rows to their fields in 2007 and 8. And then they returned years for analysis by Keiko. And the ears that came back from Iowa and Illinois, both of the comparisons between the B73 sisters and the Mo-17 sisters were significant. So our QTL work in Ames and they work in Urbana. Torbert also sent at least the B73 pair to Puerto Vallarta where they worked. He didn't send the Mo-17 pair. And then we also saw the expected result in the B73 background from North Carolina, where Mo-17 wasn't different. We saw the opposite in Pennsylvania. And then, unfortunately, as a Missouri alum, I was unhappy to see that nothing worked in Columbia Mo. But I think at this point, what we can say is that it's not specific to Aurora, New York. I don't know if we can say much more than that, but I think the fact that we can see our hypothesis supported in multiple locations suggests that we're onto something that's more generalizable and potentially more useful. So we can identify QTL for iron bioavailability based on CAECO. We can isolate nils, or what will be nils, using molecular markers. Our Backcross derivatives behave predictably in upstate New York, and to some degree at other locations. But what does this really say about nutritional quality? Right, we're growing a human colon cancer cell line in the lab and taking highly processed food samples and applying them to them. But what does this really say about reality? Well, remember, I made my Backcross derivatives in both parental backgrounds. So I can cross my high by high and my low by low and make hybrid pools, which ought to make generating larger amounts of maize much easier to do animal feeding. And that's exactly what we did. And we chose to use newly hatched Cornish broilers, as chickens will accommodate a really high amount of maize in their ration. They also don't eat all that much. But we could build diets that were otherwise balanced, but where the only source of dietary iron in at least experimental diets was coming from corn. Looking at that high by high hybrid pool, the low by low, and then a commercial yellow number two dent with added iron, according to the veterinary protocol. We could look at feed intake daily, draw blood, and weigh chickens every week, and then sacrifice the animals at the end of the experiment to do more invasive things. So in 2008, I had about 600 plants of the right genotypes, generated about 40 kilos worth of grain, and we did a small-scale experiment where we saw two really striking things. Okay, first of all, here are the high and low hybrid pools. Plants, same height, flowered at the same time. They're so similar that they actually have the same amount of iron in the grain sample. But look at the difference in the bird health. This is blood hemoglobin. Here's the high hybrid. These birds are iron sufficient. Here's the low. The birds are anemic. We are really manipulating the chemistry of the grain to make the iron more absorbable, to make this corn more nutritious. A further indication of this change in grain chemistry is the comparison to the control. The control, with added iron citrate, has more than four times as much iron as either of the experimentals, but there is no difference in the bird health. This is entirely manipulating grain chemistry. Another way to look at iron bioavailability is hemoglobin maintenance efficiency. This is the amount of iron consumed that's then converted into hemoglobin. And throughout the experiment, the birds eating that high hybrid pool can convert twice as much of the iron they consume into hemoglobin as those fed the low, in spite of the fact that there's the same elemental amount. So Ray and I would assert that the CAECO2 predictions are validated in an animal model, and that this is a useful phenotyping tool to look at nutritional quality. But was 2009 some kind of fluke? Right? We had a relatively small number of plants, relatively small number of birds, so we did it all again. Except this time, instead of having about 24 rows, I had something less than 3 acres. Different part of our farm, different field, 30,000 plants rather than 300. This time, we were harvesting more than a ton per genotype. As the workflow for CAECO uses cooked, we used cooked the first time around, but this time with more samples, we can look at raw. We can also look at cooked plus additional iron. We went for half again as long, and we increased the number of birds. But we saw basically the same thing again. So this is all in vitro. Again, we saw the same amount of iron in the high and low hybrid pools. In blue and green is the CAECO response. So there's no difference between cooked and raw in CAECO. Perhaps cooking improves the response in CAECO, but it's not cooking dependent. Okay. I guess if I was going to see a difference, I would like to see that it works in cooked and doesn't work in raw, because people eat cooked. But the fact that it works with or without cooking is encouraging, because obviously farmers if bioavailable maize is available that they can use to improve their animal health, they're not going to cook their chicken. They're not going to cook their chicken's food. Okay. But the overall picture of the second experiment reaffirms the first. If you look at the bottom, this is a recap of the previous year. This is the high cooked versus low cooked comparison. Again, looking at blood hemoglobin in the chickens. And there's a highly significant difference from this point forward. If we look at the raw, there's a difference here that sort of peters off. Although notice, these birds didn't do as well on raw maize as they did on cooked. And in the cooked supplemented, it's kind of suggestive, but it's not significant. If we look at total body hemoglobin levels, or making an estimate of total body hemoglobin based on blood levels and bird weight gain. Again, in the cooked high versus low comparison, it's significant from there out. If we look in the raw now here, we get a highly significant difference popping. So yes, cooking is probably improving bird weight gain and bird health, but the iron bioavailable difference is not cooking dependent. And again, there's not really a difference here in the cooked supplemented. Where there is a difference in the cooked supplemented is in hemoglobin maintenance efficiency. So again, like we saw before, the high cooked is highly significantly different than the low cooked without supplementary iron. If you add iron, notice the birds are ramping down how hard their bodies are working to extract iron from the foods they eat, because it's so much easier here, right? But now we get a significant difference. The high quality hybrid, even with supplementary iron, the birds are able to extract more of that out of the foods they consume, which suggests to us that we haven't merely manipulated the form of iron in the corn, but rather we've introduced promoters that are there in sufficient surplus that if you add additional iron to the diet, you still see a health benefit, such that we think that making complementary feeding trials will be possible and that we should see a corn benefit in complementary feeding. Well, okay, so what did I just tell you? I told you that we've developed genetic models and new varieties to help explain the genetic basis for seed iron bioavailability. We've started to evaluate our QTL in multiple locations, and can say with some small amount of confidence that we're not just breeding for upstate New York. We do have something that's more generalizable. We've been able to validate our lab-based bioassay using animal feeding trials, using corn grown in two separate fields in two separate years, and that we would assert that iron biofortification is achievable using conventional breeding if you have access to these specialized phenotyping tools. So what are our prospects? Well, we can go in a couple of different directions here. In the lab, from a genomics perspective, right, we've got these, they're up to BC2S5 lines, starting from about 10 different RILs in both parents. These are the perfect materials to do metabolomics on, to see how have we changed the chemistry of the grain. And then we can take advantage of the fact that we've got annotated genome sequences in corn to start prospecting for genes that are responsible for determining these QTLs and go after them either directly or by proxy. From the genetics perspective, given that from my perspective, this has been a side project, I had to concentrate what resources I had available to concentrate just on the grain bioavailability QTL. But I know there are, we've also mapped grain iron concentration QTL. And presumably, if you were to stack these within this framework, you could probably do even better. We could do that. We need to do a much better job of evaluating our varieties at multiple sites. But now as we have this more convenient toolkit, that should be pretty trivial to do, given collaborators. And we haven't really done anything from the agronomic perspective here. I mean, this has all been proof of concept for Can we dissect grain iron bioavailability? But as we have molecular markers and people like Kevin Pixley as potential collaborators, we could start introgressing our useful alleles into varieties that are locally adapted to agronomic use and food use. Right? I have no idea if these varieties will make good tortillas or what. But if we want to get to human efficacy trials, we absolutely have to do that. From the nutritionist perspective, making these hybrid crosses has made animal feeding trials immeasurably easier. And in fact, I'm sitting on about 2,000 kilos of the 2009 field now in refrigerated, low humidity storage, if we can come up with donors to support a pig trial. I mean, chickens are great, but pigs, weanling pigs, are the gold standard for human proxy. However, pigs won't let you feed them 70% corn. They don't like that. But given the result that supplementary iron to the cooked maize diet did have a health benefit to the birds, we're expecting that if we do a corn bean diet, we should see a health benefit in the pigs. Likewise, we desperately need to validate this in humans, either in single meal or extended feeding, and see if the difference that we've already detected with these three-stack QTL can provide health benefit. So, as Linda Pollack said, my name is Owen Hookinga. I work for USDA up in Ithaca, New York. Those are some of my research interests. Anyone in the audience is looking for a job? I have an open postdoc position right now. So if you're interested in working on iron biofortification, combining analytical chemistry with field-based studies, please let me know. Thank you.
We have 2 minutes for a question.
Michael Grusak.
Owen, nice presentation, nice work. Can you tell us this, whatever this component is, I'm sorry, I mean, not what it is, but
yeah.
Can you tell us how stable it might be? Do you have to maintain the grains in any sort of storage conditions in order to maintain that bioavailability factor?
We've retested materials that are at least 12 months old that we store in our seed room and still see highly significant differences similar to what we saw in freshly harvested material. We know anecdotally in the other direction that if you grind these corn samples up and you leave them on the bench for 3 years, that they don't work anymore. So they're somewhere between 12 months in refrigerated storage and 3 years ground at room temperature. But
there is some
loss.
Some loss.
Oh, yeah.
Potential.
Yeah. But we haven't, I mean, now that we have a smaller number of varieties to work with, we can do decay curves, we can abuse samples, we can do all kinds of things. But I think it's probably worth noting that all of the CAECO samples have to survive cooking, freeze drying, grinding. So whatever it is that we're looking at is not completely fragile. Victor Rayboy, are we done?
Oh, no. Okay.
Sorry.
Oh.
I'll ask you my question during my talk.
Okay.
All right. Okay. You have that right. We also have a break coming up, so we can talk to each other then.
Thank you.
Thank you.